And then, in the distance, someone screamed, and the sound jarred Kell back to the darkness and the danger. He shoved the letter and parcel both into the pocket of his coat and drew his knife across his arm, trying to ignore the dread that welled with his blood as he summoned the door home. 5. Black Stone. 1. The silver jingled in Lila's pocket as she made her way back to the stone's throw. The sun had barely set on the city, but she'd already managed a fair take that day. It was risky picking pockets by anything but night, especially with her particular disguise, which required a blurred eye or low light. But Lila had to shoulder the risk if she was going to rebuild. A map and a silver watch did not a ship buy or a fortune make. Besides, she liked the weight of coins in her pocket. They sang like a promise, added swagger to her step. A pirate without a ship, that's what she was, through and through. And one day, she'd have the ship, and then she'd sail away and be done with this wretched city once and for all. As Lila strolled down the cobblestone, she began making a mental list, as she often did, of all the things she'd need to be a proper privateer. A pair of good leather sea boots, for one, and a sword and scabbard, of course. She had the pistol, caster, beauty that it was, and her knives all sharp enough to cut, but every pirate had a sword and scabbard, at least the one she'd met, and the one she'd read about in books. Lila had never had much time for reading, but she could read. It was a good skill for a thief, and she turned out to be a quick study. And on the occasion that she nicked books, she nicked only the ones about pirates and adventures. So, a pair of good boots, a sword, and scabbard. Oh, and a hat. Lila had the black broad-brim one, but it wasn't very flashy. Didn't even have a feather, or a ribbon, or... Lila passed a boy perched on a stoop, a few doors shy of the stone's throw, and slowed, her thoughts trailing off. The boy was ragged and thin, half her age, and as dirty as a chimney broom. He was holding out his hands, palms skyward, and Lila reached into her pocket. She didn't know what made her do it. Good spirits, maybe, or the fact that the night was young, but she dropped a few coppers into the kid's cupped hands as she walked by. She didn't stop, didn't talk, and didn't acknowledge his thanks, but she did it all the same.
"Careful now,"
said Baron when she reached the tavern steps. She hadn't heard him come out.
"Someone might think you've got a heart under all that brass."
"No heart," said Lila, pulling aside her cloak to reveal the holstered pistol and one of her knives. "Just these." Baron sighed and shook his head, but she caught the edge of a smile, and behind it, something like pride. It made her squirm.
"Got anything to eat?"
she asked, toeing the step with her worn-out boot. He tipped his head toward the door, and she was about to follow him inside for a pint and a bowl of soup. She could spare that much coin, if he'd take it, when she heard a scuffle behind her. She turned to see a cluster of street rats, three of them no older than she was, hustling the ragged boy. One of the rats was fat, and one of them was skinny, and one of them was short, and all of them were obviously scum. Lila watched as the short one barred the boy's path. The fat one shoved him up against the wall. The skinny one snatched the copper coins from his fingers. The boy barely fought back. He just looked down at his hands with a kind of grim resignation. They had been empty moments before, and they were empty again. Lila's fists clenched as the three thugs vanished down a side road.
"Lila," warned Baron.
They weren't worth the work, Lila knew that. She robbed from the rich for a reason. They had more to steal. These boys probably didn't have anything worth taking besides what they'd already picked off of the boy in the street. A few coins Lila obviously hadn't minded parting with. But that wasn't the point.
"I don't like that look," said Baron when she didn't come inside.
"Hold my hat."
She thrust the top hat into his hands, but reached in as she did and pulled the nested disguise from its depths.
"They're not worth it," he said. and in case you didn't notice, there were three of them, and one of you.
So little faith,
she said, snapping the soft broad-brim hat into form.
And besides, it's the principle of the thing, Baron.
The tavern owner sighed.
Principle or not, Lila, one of these days you're going to get yourself killed.
Would you miss me?
She asked.
Like an itch, he shot back.
She gave him the edge of a grin and tied the mask over her eyes.
Look after the kid, she said, pulling the brim of the hat down over her face.
Baron grunted as she hopped down from the step.
Hey, you!
She heard Baron calling to the boy huddled on the nearby stoop, still staring at his empty hands.
Come over here!
And then she was off. 2. 7. Nareskvas. That was the address written on the envelope. Kel had sobered considerably and decided to go straight to the point of delivery and be done with the peculiar business of the letter. Rye need never know. Kel would even drop the trinket, whatever it was, in his private room at the Ruby Fields before heading back to the palace, so that he could, in good conscience, return empty-handed. It seemed like a good plan, or at least like the best of several bad ones. But as he reached the corner of Otrek and Naresk, and the address on the paper came into sight, Kel slowed and stopped, and then took two steps sideways into the nearest shadow. Something was wrong. Not in an obvious way, but under his skin, in his bones. Naraskvas looked empty, but it wasn't. That was the thing about magic. It was everywhere. In everything. In everyone. And while it coursed like a low and steady pulse through the air and the earth, it beat louder in the bodies of living things. And if Kel tried, if he reached, he could feel it. It was a sense, not as strong as sight or sound or swell, but there all the same, its presence now drifting toward him from the shadows across the street. Which meant that Kel was not alone. He held his breath and hung back in the alley, eyes fixed on the address across the street. And then, sure enough, he saw something move. A hooded figure hovered in the dark between 7 and 9 Nareskvas. Kel couldn't see anything about him except the glint of a weapon at his side. For a second, Kel, still a little off from his time with the Danes, thought it might be Olivar, the man whose letter he was holding. But it couldn't be Olivar. The woman said the man was dying, and even if he were well enough to meet Kel on the street, he couldn't know to meet him there, not when Kel himself had only just accepted the task. Which meant it wasn't Olivar. But if it wasn't him, who was it? Danger prickled at the edges of Kel's skin. He dragged the letter from his pocket, studying the address, then held his breath as he broke the seal and pulled the letter free. He bit back a curse. Even in the dark he could see that the paper was blank. Nothing but a piece of folded parchment. Kel's mind reeled. He'd been set up. If they, whoever they were, weren't after the letter, then... Sankt! Kel's hand went to the parcel still in his pocket. The payment. When his fingers curled round the folded cloth, that strange sensation ran up his arm again. What had he taken? What had he done? Just then the shadow across the street looked up. The paper in Kel's hand had caught the lantern light just for a moment, but a moment was all it took. The shadow charged forward toward Kel. And Kel turned and ran. 3. Lila trailed the group of thugs through the winding London streets, waiting for them to go their separate ways. Baron was right. The odds weren't great against all three, but she had her sights set on one. And as the three broke into two, and the two at last diverged, she followed her mark. It was the thin one she was after, the rat who'd taken the coins off skin and bones back on the step. She hugged the shadows as she trailed him through the maze of narrowing roads, the stolen copper rattling in his pocket,
a sliver of wood between his teeth. Finally, he turned off down an alley and Lila slipped after, unheard, unseen, unnoticed. As soon as they were alone, she closed the gap between them in a single stride and brought her knife up to the skinny rat's throat, pressing down hard enough to draw blood.
"Empty the pockets," she growled in a husky voice.
He didn't move.
"You're making a mistake," he said, shifting the wooden pick in his mouth.
She shifted her grip so the knife bit into his throat.
"Am I?"
And then she heard the shuffle of steps rushing up behind her and ducked just in time to dodge a fist. Another one of the rats stood there, the short sod, one meaty hand clenched, the other gripping a metal bar. And then, an instant later, the fat one finally caught up, red-cheeked and breathless.
"It's you!"
he said, and for an instant Lila thought he recognized her. Then she realized he recognized the sketch in the wanted ad.
"The shadow thief!"
The skinny one spit out his chewing stick and broke into a grin.
"Looks like we caught ourselves a prize, gents."
Lila hesitated. She knew she could win against one street rat and thought she might even be able to win against two, but three? Maybe, if they'd stand still, but they kept shifting so she couldn't see all of them at once. She heard the snick of a switchblade, the tap of the metal bar against the street stones. She had the gun in her holster and the knife in her hand and another in her boot, but she wouldn't be fast enough to level all three boys.
"Did the poster say dead or alive?"
asked the short one.
"You know, I don't think it's specified,"
said the skinny one, wiping the blood from his throat.
"I think it said dead,"
added the fat one.
"Even if it said alive,"
reasoned the skinny one,
"I don't suppose they'd mind if he were missing pieces."
He lunged for her and she lunged away, accidentally stepping into the fat one's reach. He grabbed for her and she slashed, drawing blood before the short one got his hands on her. But when his arms circled her chest, she felt his grip stiffen.
"What's this now?"
he hissed.
"Our boys are..."
Lila didn't wait. She slammed her boot into his foot, hard, and he gasped and let go. Only an instant, but it was enough for Lila to do the thing she knew she had to do. The one thing she hated to do. She ran. 4. Kel could hear the footsteps, first one set and then two and then three, or maybe the third was just the pumping of his heart, as he raced through the alleys and side streets. He didn't stop, didn't breathe, not until he reached the ruby fields. Fauna met his gaze as he passed within, her grey brow furrowing. He almost never came by the front door, but she didn't stop him, didn't ask. The footsteps had fallen away a few blocks back, but he still checked the markings on the stairs as he climbed toward the room at the top, and on the room's door, charms bound to the building itself, to wood and stone, designed to keep the room hidden from all eyes but his. Kel shut the door and sagged back against the wood as candles flickered to life around the narrow room. He'd been set up, but by who? And for what? He wasn't sure he wanted to know, but he needed to, and so he dragged the stolen parcel from his pocket. It was wrapped in a swatch of faded grey fabric, and when he unfolded the cloth, a rough-cut stone tumbled out into his palm. It was small enough to nest in a closed fist and as black as Kel's right eye, and it sang in his hand. A low, deep vibration that called on his own power like a tuning fork. Like to like. Resonating. Amplifying. His pulse quickened. Part of him wanted to drop the stone. The other part wanted to grip it tighter. When Kel held it up to the candlelight, he saw that one side was jagged as if broken, but the other was smooth. And on that smooth face a symbol glowed faintly.
Kell's heart lurched when he saw it. He'd never seen the stone before, but he recognized the mark. It was written in a language few could speak and fewer still could use, a language that ran through his veins with his blood and pulsed in his black eye, a language he had come to think of simply as Antari. But the language of magic hadn't always belonged to Antari alone. No, there were stories of a time when others could speak directly to magic, even if they couldn't command it by blood. Of a world so bonded to power that every man, woman and child became fluent in its tongue. Black London. The language of magic had belonged to them. But after the city fell, every relic had been destroyed, every remnant in every world forcibly erased as part of a cleansing, a purge, a way to ward against the plague of power that had devoured it. That was the reason there were no books written in Antari. What few texts existed now were piecemeal, the spells collected and transcribed phonetically and passed down, the original language eradicated. It made him shiver now to see it drawn as it was meant to be, not in letters, but in rune, the only rune he knew. Kell possessed a single book on Antari tongue, entrusted to him by his tutor Tiran. It was a leather journal filled with blood commands, spells that summoned light or darkness, encouraged growth, broke enchantments. All of them sounded out and explained. But on its cover, there was a symbol. "What does it mean?" he'd asked the tutor. "It's a word," explained Tiran, "one that belongs to every world and none. It is the word for magic. It refers to its existence and its creation." Tiran brought a finger to the rune. "If magic had a name, it would be this," he said, tracing the symbol's lines. "Vitari." Now Kell ran his thumb over the stone's rune, the word echoing in his head. "Vitari." Just then footsteps fell on the stairs and Kell stiffened. No one should be able to see those stairs, let alone use them, but he could hear the boots. How had they followed him here? And that's when Kell saw the pattern on the swatch of pale fabric that had once been wrapped around the stone and now lay unfolded on his bed. There were symbols scrawled across it. A tracing spell. Sanct. Kell shoved the stone in his pocket and lunged for the window as the small door behind him burst open violently. He mounted the sill and jumped out and down, hitting the street below hard and rolling to his feet as the intruders came crashing into his room. Someone had set him up. Someone wanted him to bring a forbidden relic out of White London and into his city. A figure leaped through the window in his wake, and Kell spun to face the shadows on his heels. He expected two of them, but found only one. The hooded stranger slowed and stopped.
"Who are you?"
demanded Kell. The shadow didn't answer him. It strode forward, reaching for the weapon at its hip, and in the low alley light Kell saw an X scarred the back of his hand. The mark of cutthroats and traitors, a knife for hire. But when the man drew his weapon, Kell froze. It was no rusted dagger, but a gleaming half-sword, and he knew the sigil on its hilt. The chalice and rising sun, the symbol of the royal family. It was the blade wielded by members of the royal guard, and only by them.
"Where did you get that?"
growled Kell, anger rolling through him. The cutthroat flexed his fingers around his half-sword. It began to glow dully, and Kell tensed. The swords of the royal guards weren't just beautiful or sharp. They were enchanted. Kell himself had helped create the spellwork that ran through the metal, spellwork that dampened a magician's power with only one cut. The blades were designed to put a stop to conflicts before they began, to remove the threat of magical retaliation. Because of their potential, and the fear of that potential in the wrong hands, the royal guards were told to keep the blade on them at all times. If one of them had lost their sword, they'd likely lost their life as well.
"Saranac!" said the cutthroat.
"Surrender."
The command caught Kel by surprise.
Knives for hire took loot and blood, not prisoners.
"Put down that sword," ordered Kel.
He tried to will the weapon from a cutthroat's grip, but it was warded. Another failsafe to keep the blade from falling into the wrong hands, which it already had. Kel swore and drew his own knife from its holster. It was a good foot shorter than the royal blade.
"Surrender,"
said the cutthroat again, his voice strangely even. He tilted up his chin, and Kel caught a glimmer of magic in the man's eyes. A compulsion spell. Kel had only a moment to note the use of forbidden magic before the man lunged, the glowing weapon slicing through the air toward him. He jerked back, dodging the sword, as a second figure appeared at the other end of the alley.
"Surrender,"
said the second man.
"One at a time," snapped Kel.
He threw his hand into the air, and the street stones shuddered and then shot upward in a wall of rock and dirt, barring the second attacker's path. But the first kept coming, kept slashing, and Kel scrambled backward out of the sword's arc. He almost made it. The blade caught his arm, slicing through fabric but narrowly missing his skin. He lunged away as the weapon cut again, but this time it found flesh, slashing across his ribs. Pain tore through Kel's chest as blood welled and spilled down his stomach. The man pressed forward, and Kel retreated a step and tried to will the street stones to rise between them. They shuddered and laid still.
"Surrender,"
ordered the cutthroat in his too even tone. Kel pressed his hand to his shirt front, trying to stem the blood as he dodged another slice.
"No!"
He spun the dagger in his hand, took it by the tip, and threw as hard as he could. The blade found its mark and buried itself in the cutthroat's shoulder. But to Kel's horror, the man didn't drop his weapon. He kept coming. Pain didn't even register on his face as he pulled the knife free and cast it aside.
"Surrender the stone," he said,
dead-eyed. Kel's hand closed protectively around the talisman in his pocket. It hummed against his palm, and Kel realized as he held it that even if he could give it away, which he couldn't, he wouldn't, not without knowing what it was for and who was after it. He didn't want to let it go, couldn't bear the thought of parting with it, which was absurd. And yet, something in him ached to keep it. The cutthroat came at him again. Kel tried to take another step back, but his shoulders met the makeshift barricade. There was nowhere to run. Darkness glittered in the cutthroat's eyes, and his blade sang through the air, and Kel threw out his empty hand and ordered, "Stop!" as if that would do a damned thing. And yet somehow, it did. The word echoed through the alley, and between one reverberation and the next, the night changed around him. Time seemed to slow, and so did the cutthroat, and so did Kel, but the stone clutched in his hand surged to life. Kel's own magic had bled out through the wound across his ribs, but the stone sang with power, and thick black smoke poured between his fingers. It shot up Kel's arm and across his chest and down his outstretched hand and rushed forward through the air toward the cutthroat. When the smoke reached him, it did not strike him, did not force him off his feet. Instead, it twisted and coiled around the cutthroat's body, spreading over his legs, up his arms, around his chest. And everywhere it touched, as soon as it touched, it froze, catching the cutthroat between one stride and the next, one breath and the next. Time snapped back into motion, and Kel gasped, his pulse pounding in his ears and the stones singing in his grip. The stolen royal blade hung mid-slash, inches from his face. The cutthroat himself stood motionless, his coat caught mid-billow behind him. Through the sheet of shadowy ice or stone or whatever it was, Kell could see the cutthroat's stiff form, eyes open and empty. Not the blank gaze of the compelled, but the vacancy of the dead. Kell stared down at the stone still thrumming in his hand, at the glowing symbol on its face. Vitari. It is the word for magic. It refers to its existence and its creation. Could it also mean the act of creating? There was no blood command for create. The golden rule of magic said that it couldn't be created. The world was made of give and take, and magic could be strengthened and weakened, but it could not be manifested out of nothing. And yet, he reached out to touch the frozen man. Had the power somehow been summoned by his blood? But he hadn't given a blood command, hadn't done anything but say stop. The stone had done the rest, which was impossible. Even with the strongest elemental magic, one had to focus on the form they wanted it to take. But Kell hadn't envisioned the frozen shell, which meant the stone didn't simply follow an order. It interpreted. It created. Was this the way magic had worked in Black London? Without walls, without rules, without anything but want and will? Kell forced himself to return the talisman to his pocket. His fingers didn't want to relinquish it. It took all his focus to let go, and the moment the stone slipped from his hand back into his coat, a dizzy chill ran through him, and the world rocked. He felt weak as well as wounded, drained. It isn't something for nothing after all, thought Kell, but it was still something. Something powerful. Something dangerous. He tried to straighten, but pain tore across his stomach and he groaned, slumping back against the alley wall. Without his power, he couldn't will the wound closed, couldn't even keep his own blood in his veins. He needed to catch his breath, needed to clear his mind, needed to think. But just then the stones at his back began to shake, and he pushed off the wall an instant before it crumbled to reveal the second hooded figure.
"Surrender!" said the man in the same even tone as his counterpart.
Kell could not. He didn't trust the stone. Even as he itched to take hold of it again, didn't know how to control it, but neither could he surrender it. So Kell lunged forward, recovering his own knife from the ground, and when the man came at him, he buried it in his attacker's chest. For a second, Kell worried the man wouldn't go down, feared the compulsion would keep him on his feet as it had the other one. Kell forced the blade deep and wrenched it up through organ and bone. And at last the man's knees buckled. For one brief moment the compulsion broke and the light flooded back into his eyes. And then it was gone. It wasn't the first time Kell had killed someone, but he still felt ill as he pulled the knife free and the man crumpled dead at his feet. The alley swayed, and Kell clutched his stomach, fighting for breath as pain rolled through him. And then he heard another set of steps in the distance and forced himself upright. He stumbled past the bodies, the frozen and the fallen both, and ran. 5. Kell couldn't stop the blood. It soaked through his shirt front, the fabric clinging to him as he ran, stumbled through the narrow maze of streets that gathered web-like in the corners of Red London. He clutched at his pocket to make sure the stone was safe, and a thrum ran through his fingers as they felt it there. He should have run for the river, should have pitched the talisman into the glittering isle and let it sink. He should have, but he hadn't, and that left him with a problem. And the problem was catching up. Kell cut a corner too sharp and skidded into the wall, biting back a gasp as his wounded side collided with the bricks. He couldn't keep running, but he had to get away. Somewhere he wouldn't be followed. Somewhere he couldn't be followed. Kell dragged himself to a stop and reached for the grey London pendant at his neck, ripping the cord over his head. Footsteps echoed, heavy and too close. But Kell held his ground and pressed his hand to his blood-soaked ribs, wincing. He brought his palm of the coin in it against the alley stones and said,
"Us Travers!"
He felt the word pass his lips and shiver against his hand at the same time. But nothing happened. The wall stayed where it was, and so did Kell. Pain tore white-hot through his side from the royal blade, the spell work cutting him off from his power.
"No," pleaded Kell silently.
Blood magic was the strongest kind in the world. It couldn't be disabled, not by a simple piece of spell work. It was stronger. It had to be stronger. Kell closed his eyes.
"Us Travers,"
he said again. He shouldn't have to say anything else, shouldn't have to force it, but he was tired and bleeding and fighting to focus his eyes, let alone his power, and so he added,
"Please."
He swallowed and brought his forehead to rest against the stones and heard the steps getting closer and closer, and said again,
"Please, let me through!"
The stone hummed in his pocket, a whispered promise of power, of aid, and he was about to draw it out and call upon its strength when the wall finally shuddered and gave way beneath his touch. The world vanished, and an instant later reappeared, and Kell collapsed to the cobblestone street, the subtle, steady light of red London replaced by the dank, smoke-filled, grey London night. He stayed a moment on his hands and knees and actually considered losing consciousness right there in the alley, but finally managed to get to his feet. When he did, the city slanted dangerously around him. He took two steps and promptly collided with a man in a mask and a broad-brim hat. Distantly, Kell knew it was strange to be wearing a disguise, but he was hardly in a position to judge appearances given his current state.
"Sorry,"
he mumbled, pulling his coat close around him to hide the blood.
"Where'd you come from?"
asked the man, and Kell looked up and realized that under that disguise it wasn't a man at all. It was a woman. Not even that. A girl, all stretched out like a shadow, like Kell, but one even later in the day. Too long, too thin. But she was dressed like a man, boots and breeches and a cloak, and under that a few glinting weapons, and, of course, the mask and the hat. She seemed out of breath as though she'd been running. "Strange," thought Kell again. He swayed a little on his feet.
"You all right there, gent?"
asked the girl in disguise. Footsteps sounded in the street beyond the alley, and Kell tensed, forcing himself to remember that he was safe now, safe here. The girl cast a quick glance back before returning her attention to him. He took a step toward her, and his legs nearly buckled beneath him. She went to catch him, but he caught himself against the wall first.
"I'll be okay," he whispered shakily.
The girl tipped her chin up, and there was something strong and defiant in her eyes and the lines of her jaw. A challenge. And then she smiled. Not with her whole mouth, just the edges. And Kell thought, in a far-off woozy way, that under different circumstances they might have been friends.
"There's blood on your face," she said.
Where wasn't there blood? Kell brought his hand to his cheek, but his hand was damp with it too, so it wasn't much help. The girl came closer. She drew a small dark kerchief from her pocket and reached out, dabbing his jaw with it before pressing the fabric into his hand.
"Keep it," she said,
and then she turned and strode away. Cal watched the strange girl go, then slumped back against the alley wall. He tipped his head back and stared up at the grey London sky, starless and bleak over the tops of the buildings. And then he reached into his pocket for the black London stone. And froze. It wasn't there. He dug furiously through his pockets, every one of them, but it was no good. The talisman was gone. Breathless and bleeding and exhausted, Kell looked down at the kerchief clutched in his hand. He couldn't believe it. He'd been robbed. 6. Thieves meet. 1. A London away, the city bells struck 8. The sound came from the sanctuary at the city's edge, but it rang out over the glittering aisle and through the streets, pouring in open windows and out open doors and down alleys until it reached the ruby fields, and, just beyond, the frozen figure of a man in the dark. A man with an X on the back of his hand and a stolen royal sword still raised above his head. A man trapped in ice, or stone, or something stranger. As the bells trailed off, a jagged crack formed in the shell over the man's face, and then another down his arm, and a third along the blade. Small fissures that deepened quickly, spreading like fingers through the casing. "Stop!" the young Antari had ordered his attacker, and the attacker had not listened, but the magic had. It had poured out of the black stone in the Antari's hand, coiled around the man, and hardened into a shell. And now the shell was breaking. Not as a shell should break, the surface fracturing and the shards crumbling away, raining down upon the street. No, this shell broke apart and yet never let go of the man beneath. Instead, it clung to him as it melted, not down his body, but into it, seeping in through his clothes and his skin until it was gone, or not gone, absorbed. The once frozen man shuddered, then took a breath. The royal half-sword slipped from his fingers and clattered to the stones as the last shimmering drops of magic glistened like oil on his skin before sinking in, the veins darkening, tracing over him like ink. The man's head hung forward, eyes open but empty, and fully black, pupils blown and spreading through irises and into whites. The compulsion spell already cast on him had stripped the man's resistance and allowed the other magic to slip right in, through vein and brain and muscle, taking hold of everything it touched, the once red core of life now burning pure and dark. Slowly the man, or rather now the thing inside him, lifted his head. His black eyes shone, slick against the dry dark as he surveyed the alley. The body of the second cutthroat lay nearby, but he was already quite dead, the light snuffed out. Nothing to salvage. Nothing to burn. There wasn't much life left in his own body either. Just enough flame to feed on. But it would do for now. He rolled his shoulders and began to walk, haltingly at first, as a man unused to his body. And then faster, surer. His posture straightened and his legs strode toward the lights of the nearest building. The man's mouth drew into a smile. It was late, but the lanterns were lit in the windows, and laughter, high and sweet and promising, filled the air like the sound of bells. 2. Lila hummed as she made her way back to the stone's throw. As she walked, she began to divest herself of the disguise. The mask came off first, followed by the broad-brim hat. She'd forgotten she was wearing them when she ran into the drunk fellow back in the alley, but he'd been so deep in his cups that he'd hardly seemed to notice. Just as he'd hardly seemed to notice her hand in his coat as she held up the kerchief, or her fingers curling around the contents of his pocket as she pressed the dark cloth into his palm. An easy mark. Truth be told, she was still cross with herself for running, or rather for falling into a trap and needing to run from the trio of street rats. But, she thought, closing her hand around the satisfying weight in her cloak pocket, the outing hadn't been a total waste. As the tavern came into sight, she pulled the trinket from her cloak and paused beneath a lamppost to get a closer look at the take. When she did, her heart sank. She'd hoped for metal, something silver or gold, but the lump was stone. Not a gem or a jewel either, not even a bit of crystal. It looked like a river rock, glossy and black, one side smooth and the other jagged, like it had been smashed or chipped off from a larger piece of stone. What kind of gent walked around with rocks in his pocket? And broken ones at that. And yet, she thought she could feel something, a kind of prickle where her skin met the stone's surface. Lila held it up to the light and squinted at it a moment before dismissing the sensation and deeming the rock worthless. A sentimental trifle at best. Her mood soured as she shoved it back in her pocket and climbed the steps of the stone's throw. Even though the tavern was bustling, Baron looked up when she came in, eyes going from her face to the disguise tucked under her arm. She thought she saw a flicker of concern, and it made her cringe. She wasn't his family. He wasn't hers. She didn't need his worry, and he didn't need her wait.
"Run into trouble?"
he asked as she passed up the counter and went straight for the stairs. She wasn't about to own up to being snared in the alley or running away from the fight, and her take had been a total bust, so she simply shrugged.
"Nothing I couldn't handle."
The scrawny boy from the steps sat on a corner stool eating a bowl of stew. Lila realized she was hungry, that is to say, hungrier than usual. Lila hadn't felt full in years. But she was tired, too, and relieved to find that the call of her bones to bed was louder than that of her stomach to table. Besides, she hadn't retrieved the coins. She had the silver, of course, but she had to save it if she was ever going to get out of this tavern, out of this city. Lila knew too well how the cycle went, thieves stealing only enough to stay thieves. She had no intention of contenting herself to such meagre victories. And now that she'd been made, she cursed the thought of three street rats discovering what 36 constables hadn't, that their wanted man wasn't a man at all. Stealing would only get harder. She needed larger scores, and she needed them soon. Her stomach growled, and she knew Baron would give her something for nothing if she could bring herself to ask for it, but she couldn't. She wouldn't. Lila Bard might have been a thief, but she wasn't a beggar. And when she left, and she would, she had every intention of leaving behind the coin she owed him, down to the last farthing. She set off up the stairs. At the top of the narrow steps stood a little landing with a green door. She remembered slamming that same door, shoving past Baron and down the steps, leaving only a tantrum in her wake. She remembered the fight. She'd stolen from a patron, and Baron had put her to task for it. What was worse, he'd wanted rent but barred her from paying him room and board with any borrowed coin. He'd wanted only honest money, and she had no way to get it, so he'd offered to pay her to help him run the tavern. She'd shot him down. Saying yes would have meant staying, and staying would have meant settling. In the end, it had been easier to hang the place and run. Not away, Lila had told herself. No, Lila had been running toward something, something better. And even if she hadn't reached it yet, she would.
"This isn't a life,"
she'd shouted, the handful of things she owed shoved under her arm.
"This isn't anything. It's not enough. It's not fucking enough."
She hadn't adopted the disguise yet, hadn't been bold enough to rob outright. "There has to be more," she'd thought. "I have to be more." She grabbed the broad-brim hat from a hook near the door as she'd stormed out. It hadn't been hers, Baron hadn't tried to stop her. He'd only gotten out of her way. A life worth having is a life worth taking. It had been almost a year, 11 months, 2 weeks, and a handful of days since she'd stormed away from the little room at the stone's throw, swearing she was done with both. And yet here she was again. She reached the top of the stairs, each protesting her arrival as much as she did, and let herself in. The sight of the room filled her with a mix of revulsion and relief. Bone-tired, she dug the rock from her pocket and dropped it with a thud onto a wooden table by the door. Baron had set her top hat on the bed, and Lila sank down beside it to unlace her boots. They were worn to nearly nothing, and she cringed at the thought of how much it would cost to buy a decent pair. It wasn't an easy thing to steal. Relieving a man of his pocket watch was one thing. Relieving him of his shoes was quite another. She was halfway through the strings on the first boot when she heard a sound of strain like an oof, and looked up to find a man standing in her bedroom. He hadn't come through the door. It was locked. And yet there he was, one bloody hand braced against the wall. Lila's kerchief was balled up between his palm and the wooden boards, and she thought she could make out a mark of some sort ghosted into the panelling beneath. His hair hung down into his eyes, but she recognised him at once. It was the fellow from the alley, the drunk one.
"Give it back,"
he said, breathing heavily. He had a faint accent, one she couldn't place.
"How the bloody hell did you get in?"
she asked, rising to her feet.
"You have to give it back."
Here in the light of the close little room she could see the shirt matted to his chest, the sheen of sweat across his brow.
"You shouldn't have taken it."
Lila's eyes flicked to the stone where it sat on the table, and his gaze followed and stuck. They lunged for it at the same time, or rather Lila lunged for it. The stranger pushed off the wall in that general direction, swayed sharply, and then collapsed at her feet. His head bounced a little when it hit the floor. "Great," thought Lila, staring down at his body. She toed his shoulder with her boot, and when he didn't move, she knelt and rolled him over. He looked like he'd had a hell of a night. His black tunic was stuck to his skin. At first she thought it was sweat, but when she touched it, her fingers came away red. She considered searching his pockets and dumping his body out the window, but then she noticed the faint rise and fall of his chest through his stained shirt and realized he was not, in fact, dead. Yet. Up close, the stranger wasn't nearly as old as she'd first thought. Beneath a bit of soot and blood, his skin was smooth, and his face still held some boyish angles. He looked to be a year or two older than Lila herself, but not much more. She brushed the coppery hair from his forehead, and his eyelids fluttered and began to drift open. Lila pulled back sharply. One of his eyes was a lovely blue. The other was pitch black. Not black-irised, like some of the men she'd seen from the Far East, but a pure, unnatural black, running edge to edge, uninterrupted by colour or white. His gaze began to focus, and Lila reached for the nearest thing, a book, and struck him with it. His head lolled, and his body went slack. And when he showed no signs of waking, she set the book aside and took hold of his wrists. "He smells like flowers," she thought absently as she dragged his body across the floor. 3. When Kel came to, he was tied to a bed. Coarse rope wound over his wrists, pinning them to the headboard behind him. His head was pounding and dull pain spread through his ribs when he tried to move, but at least the bleeding had stopped. And when he reached for his power, he was relieved to feel it rise to meet him. The royal blade spell had worn off. After a few moments of self-assessment, Kel realized he wasn't alone in the room. Dragging his head up off the pillow, he found the thief perched in a chair at the foot of the bed, winding up the silver timepiece and watching him over her knees. She'd done away with her disguise, and Kell was surprised by the face beneath. Her dark hair was cut short along her jaw, which ended at a pointed chin. She looked young but sharp, bony in a starved bird kind of way. The only roundness came from her eyes, both brown but not quite the same shade. He opened his mouth, intending to start their conversation with a question like, "Will you untie me?" or "Where is the stone?" but instead found himself saying,
"One of your eyes is lighter than the other."
"And one of your eyes is black," she shot back. She sounded cautious but not frightened, or if she was, she was very good at hiding it. "What are you?" she asked.
"A monster," said Kell hoarsely. "You better let me go."
The girl gave a small mocking laugh. "Monsters don't faint in the presence of ladies."
"Ladies don't dress like men and pick pockets," retorted Kell.
Her smile only sharpened. "What are you, really?"
"Tied to your bed," said Kell matter-of-factly.
"And?"
His brow furrowed. "And in trouble."
That at least garnered a sliver of surprise. "Aside from the obvious being tied to my bed?"
"Yes,"
said Kell, struggling to sit up a little despite the binds so he could look in her eye.
"I need you to let me go and give me back the thing you stole."
He scanned the room, hoping to catch sight of the stone, but it no longer sat on the table.
"I won't turn you in," he added. "We'll pretend this never happened. But I need it."
He hoped she would glance, inch, even lean, in the direction of the talisman, but she stayed perfectly still, her gaze unwavering.
"How did you get in here?"
she asked. Kell chewed his cheek.
"You wouldn't believe me,"
he said dismissively. She shrugged.
"I suppose we'll find out."
He hesitated. She hadn't flinched at the sight of his eye, and she hadn't turned him in or called for help when he marched bloodstained through a wall and into her room. The grey world knew so little of magic, had forgotten so much, but there was something in the girl's gaze, a challenge that made him wonder if she would prove him wrong. If she could.
"What is your name?" he asked.
"Don't change the subject."
"I'm not,"
he said, twining his fingers around the ropes, binding him to the bed.
"I want only to know my captor."
She considered him a moment before answering.
"Delilah Bard," she said. "But Lila will do."
Lila, a soft name, but she used it like a knife, slashing out on the first syllable, the second barely a whisper of metal through air.
"And my captive?"
"Kell," he said. "My name is Kell, and I come from another London, and I got into your room using magic."
Sure enough, her lips quirked.
"Magic,"
she echoed dryly.
"Yes," he said. "Magic."
This time, when he said the word, his grip tightened on the ropes, and they caught fire and burned instantly to ash. A bit showy, perhaps, but it had the desired effect. Lila stiffened visibly in her chair as Kell sat fully upright on the bed. A wave of dizziness rolled over him, and he paused there, rubbing his wrists while he waited for the room to right itself.
"Specifically," he said, "I used magic to make a door."
He patted himself down and discovered that his knife was missing. She'd disarmed him. He frowned and swung his legs slowly off the bed, boots coming to rest against the floor.
"When you picked my pocket in the alley, you gave me your kerchief. I was able to use it to make a door. One that led from me to you."
Which was, incidentally, much harder than it sounded. Doors were meant to lead to places, not people. It was only the second time Kell had ever successfully used his magic to find his way to someone. Not to mention, he had been bleeding power with every step. It had been too much. The last dregs of magic had gotten him here. And then,
"'Another London?' said Lila.
"'Yes.'
"'And you made a door?'
"'Yes.'
"'Using magic?'
"'Yes.'
He met her eyes then, expecting confusion, scepticism, disbelief, and finding something else. She was staring at him blankly.
No, not blankly. Her gaze was intense, assessing.
Kel hoped she wouldn't ask for another demonstration. His power was only just trickling back, and he needed to save it. She lifted a finger to the wall where the ghosted echo of his door still lingered.
"'I guess that explains the mark.'
Kel frowned a little. Most people here couldn't see the echoes of spell work, or at least they didn't notice them. The marks, like most magic, passed beneath the spectrum of their senses.
"'And the rock?'
she asked.
"'Magic,' he said.
"'Black magic. Strong magic. Dead magic.
Bad magic.'
Finally Lila slipped. For the briefest moment, her eyes flicked to a chest along the wall. Kel didn't hesitate. He lunged for the top drawer, but before his fingers met the wooden knife, found his throat.
It had come out of nowhere.
A pocket, a sleeve, a thin blade resting just below his chin. Lila's smile was as sharp as its metal edge.
"'Sit down before you fall down, magic boy.'
Lila lowered the knife and Kel sank slowly onto the foot of the bed. And then she surprised him a second time by producing the talisman, not from the top drawer of the chest, as she'd hinted, but out of thin air. One moment her palm was empty, and the next the stone was simply there, her sleight of hand flawless. Kel swallowed, thinking. He could strip the knife from her grip, but she probably had another, and worse, she had the stone. She was human and knew nothing of magic, but if she made a request, the stone might very well answer. Kel thought of the cutthroat encased in rock. Lila ran her thumb over the talisman.
"'What's so bad about it?'
He hesitated, choosing his words.
"'It should not exist.'
"'What is it worth?'
"'Your life,' said Kel, clenching his fists. "'Because, trust me, whoever's after me will kill you in a blink to take it back.'
Lila's gaze went to the window.
"'Were you followed?'
Kel shook his head.
"'No,' he said slowly. "'They can't follow me here.'
"'Then I have nothing to worry about.'
Her attention returned to the talisman. Kel could see the curiosity burning through her, and he wondered if the stone pulled at her the way it had at him.
"'Lila,' he said slowly, "'please put it down.'
She squinted at the symbol on its face as if somehow that would help her read it.
"'What does it mean?'
Kel did not answer.
"'If you tell me, I will give it back.'
Kel did not believe her, but answered anyway.
"'It's the symbol for magic,' he said. "'Vitari.'
"'A magic stone called magic? Not very original. What does it do?'
"'I don't know.
It was a kind of truth.
"'I don't believe you.'
"'I don't care.'
Lila frowned.
"'I'm beginning to think you don't want it back.'
"'I don't,' said Kel, and it was mostly true, though a part of him wanted nothing more than to hold it again. "'But I need it. And I answered your question.'
Lila considered the stone.
"'A magic stone called magic,'
she mused, turning it over in her palm.
"'Which leads me to believe that it, what, makes magic?' "'Or makes things out of magic?'
"'She must have seen the answer in Kel's worried face, "'because she smiled triumphantly.
"'A source of power, then?'
She appeared to be having a conversation with herself.
"Can it make anything? I wonder how it works."
Kel went